This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Apparently, few people took the relationship seriously when the esteemed writer Christopher Isherwood became involved with Don Bacardi, who was still a teenager, about 30 years younger than Isherwood. But the relationship lasted over 30 years until Isherwood's death in 1986. Their story is the subject of the new documentary, Chris and Don. Don Bacardi is my guest. His life with Christopher Isherwood reveals something of what it was like to be openly gay in Hollywood in the 50s and 60s. Isherwood was a British writer who became an American citizen in 1946. He's best known for his short story collection, The Berlin Stories, based on his experiences living in Berlin just before World War II. The Broadway show and movie musical Cabaret were adapted from those stories. So were the play and film I Am a Camera. Isherwood also co-wrote several screenplays, including Rage in Heaven and The Loved One. With Isherwood's encouragement, Don Bacardi became a portrait painter. His work is in the permanent collections of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Smithsonian, and the National Portrait Gallery in London. Don Bacardi, welcome to Fresh Air. That must have been a real emotional experience for you, being in this documentary, immersing yourself in an earlier part of your life and in your relationship with the late Christopher Isherwood.
Yes, it was, and it still is. Every time I see it, I can't help being moved by it. That early footage of Chris and me seems very touching to me now.
But you're so young.
Yes, indeed I was.
When you
looked even younger than I was.
You're right. How old were you?
18.
18.
So, and that same year, I went with Chris to New York for the first time, and a serious rumor went around town that Christopher had brought a 12-year-old with him from California. And people believed it, and I looked the part.
Okay, so you were 18 when you started seeing each other, and he was 30 years older. Did you think of yourself as gay at that point? Had you had gay relationships before? Were you certain of your sexual orientation?
Oh, I was certain. I'd had a few encounters, but I was still relatively green in my experience. But I certainly knew without a doubt that I was queer.
What was your first reaction to the 30-year age difference between you and Christopher Isherwood? Did that seem like a lot to you? Did he seem way older than you?
He was actually a year older than my father, but he didn't seem so. He seemed ages younger, and he seemed really out of the category of anybody that I might consider for a sexual relationship, but he was so boyish in his look and so witty and charming. And I felt at ease with him almost immediately. And it wasn't until many years later that I realized that in many respects, Chris was much younger than I. He was much more curious. He was still capable of being awed by his experience like a young man. And that was really quite sobering for me to realize.
What were some of the difficulties of being in a relationship when you were young, still a teenager, and unformed, and your partner was an older, established writer with a circle of friends and colleagues, many of them celebrities? Did it make you insecure at all? Did you have an identity crisis?
Social situations were sometimes difficult, but then Chris was always there to shore me up. And I felt his support. He never let me flounder. And the fact that I was in his company meant that I didn't have to worry about making conversation, because he was a wonderful conversationalist. And that allowed me to drink in everybody that I met. And that was very exciting because often they were the very movie stars that I'd idolized since I was a child.
Because you were so much younger, did some of his friends think that you were just a toy for him?
Oh, yes. I looked like a toy boy. And while I enjoyed their interest in me for my looks, yes, of course, all young people want to be taken seriously as mature personalities. But I was quite pleased to be admired physically. But as I got older, I wanted more, and that was good because it made me think seriously about how I could make something of myself.
One of the interviewees in the movie, Chris and Don, says about you, it was if Chris had cloned himself because you'd picked up some of his mannerisms and some of his British accent. Were you aware of that at the time?
Well, I gradually realized that I was, and still am, an unconscious mimic, that I instinctively took on the sounds of people I was around with a lot. And that happened very early with Chris. Within a year, I believe I was already beginning to sound a bit like him. But I wasn't aware of it and got a big shock when I first heard my voice recorded. And there were several people in the room, and I looked around and said, "I don't sound like that, do I?" And they all agreed, "Yes, yes, that sounds exactly like you." And I was horrified because I knew that people who'd known me before I knew Chris would think I'd become wildly affected. But since I couldn't hear it myself, there was little I could do about it.
Do you think he saw things in you that you didn't yet see in yourself?
Yes, I know he did, and he tried to help me to see them and to believe in myself. Like many young people, I was lacking in confidence. I was shy. Well, my mother was extremely shy, and I think I'd been mimicking her for years. And my instinctive mimicry, it was only years later that I realized that that was a very important aspect of my work as an artist. I always drew pictures of people and only people, and I began to realize that I was mimicking them, my idols, when I was working with them. Well, because I had the wonderful experience of being able to draw from life many of the people I'd drawn from magazine pictures when I was a child.
Christopher Isherwood sent you to art school when he realized that you had talent. And you loved art school and you developed into, a painter and sketch artist doing, portraits of people. Did it change your relationship with Christopher Isherwood when you became an artist in your own right?
Oh, it was a very important change from my point of view because I'd found my vocation. And once I got to art school, I worked at it day and night. I went all day long, and I was often back for the evening class. And it was of great importance to me to establish my own identity. And I knew that I had to do that if the relationship between us was to be preserved.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Don Bacardi. And the new movie, Chris and Don, is about his 33-year relationship with the writer Christopher Isherwood. You were both always out as a couple. You never pretended that you were heterosexual. You showed up at parties together. What was it like to be out in Hollywood? And Christopher Isherwood was writing for Hollywood. What was it like to be out in Hollywood in the 50s and 60s, before Stonewall, before the gay liberation movement?
Well, I suppose without realizing it, we were early pioneers. But we had really very little choice. First of all, Chris was a distinguished writer who was fairly well known to be homosexual, so anybody that he appeared with frequently was assumed, especially if he were youthful and presentable, was presumed to be a boyfriend. And we weren't going to pretend that we weren't living together, so it would have been unnatural for Chris to leave me at home, and he wouldn't dream of doing that anyway, because he was an above-board personality. He wasn't about to cringe just because he was engaged in a relationship that was frowned on by society. He was, in his heart, a genuine rebel.
You and Christopher Isherwood were friends with the actor Tony Perkins. And my understanding is that he was trying hard not to be gay. He was married, had a child. Was he in therapy trying to, you know, like overcome gayness? And did you watch him go through difficult periods?
Oh, I think he spent years on therapy and hoping that he could transform himself into a heterosexual. Thank goodness that was never a problem for either Chris or me. And in fact, everything that I value in my life has come to me through my queerness. And I've had an extremely lucky life. So we understood Perkins and sympathized with him, but that was certainly not a feeling that we suffered from. We both, Chris and I, were very, very pleased to be queer.
You had dreamed of being a Hollywood actor when you were a child, and then spent as much time in movie theaters as possible when you were growing up. And then when you met a lot of Hollywood actors, initially through Christopher Isherwood, what was it like to you to see the people in person who you'd only seen on screen before?
Well, it was a visual feast. And I gobbled them up visually. And Chris, of course, once I became an artist, went out of his way to meet movie actors, because he was setting them up for a request from me to do a sitting with them. And I was so lucky that many of them agreed, and I soon put together quite a considerable collection of portraits of Hollywood people, but also of very famous writers, composers, and painters, too.
The movie Cabaret and the Broadway show Cabaret are both based on a short story that Christopher Isherwood wrote, based on somebody who he met in the 1930s when he was living in Berlin. And in the movie, you say that Isherwood didn't really like the show that much because Liza Minnelli was just such a terrific singer in Cabaret, and the character of Sally Bowles is supposed to be a real amateur. So it was hard to square those two things. But what did you both think of the whole idea of turning the short story about Sally Bowles into a musical?
Well, it's so easy to lose the character of Sally Bowles, because as soon as she's played by a very talented professional actress and singer, as Liza Minnelli is, you lose an essential quality of Sally Bowles, because she was nothing if she wasn't an amateur. And Liza Minnelli would have been the toast of Europe, belting those songs out. How could she possibly also be little no-talent Sally Bowles, however charming she is? And, of course, Chris couldn't help being aware of that. Before he saw the movie, he actually thought Liza Minnelli might be very good casting. We'd seen her in two films, The Sterile Cuckoo and Junie Moon, and she was clearly very talented. He thought she might be just wonderful. But as soon as she comes on belting those songs, I said she's not Sally Bowles.
You went through a period in your relationship with Christopher Isherwood, and this is described in the documentary about your relationship, Chris and Don. You went through a period when you insisted that you needed to see other men, that Isherwood had had a period of his life before he met you when he had other relationships, and you needed to go through that period too. So how did you both deal with jealousy and possessiveness? Was that easy or difficult?
Very difficult, but because it required the maximum of tact and consideration and delicacy. And always I felt the responsibility, and I know Chris did too, to whomever we were seeing on the side, to always make it clear to the other that he was and always would be number one. If one keeps that in mind, I do think one could do miracle turns around jealousy and resentment. But I myself was always very careful to let Chris know there was no question that anybody would ever mean to me what he did.
Does that mean that you talked to each other about other people you were seeing?
No. We never did. And we didn't want to know. It was better not to know. What mattered was not who we were with when we were apart, but what we were like together when we were together. And that's where all of the important negotiations are made. We were always so happy spend an evening together. And we always made the other know that that was the case. I know it sounds kind of never land, but somehow we managed it. And, we both had to be very sensitive.
When Christopher Isherwood was dying of prostate cancer, you took care of him. You also sketched him. You did a series of, I think it was pen and ink drawings on his deathbed. Why did you want to spend those last few days of his life at his side drawing him?
Well, I always intended to look after him and keep him home, keep him out of a hospital. That was his idea of a horrible death, a death in a hospital. So for many, many years, that was my intention. And then when he got sick and began to fail, we were often in the house alone together. And yes, there were things I did for him, but what about the rest of my day? So I canceled all my sittings. The last 6 months of his life, I only worked with him. And I worked with him almost every day and often did as many as a dozen drawings a day, fast ones, slow ones, the best I could manage.
But did that kind of provide a structure for you both to be together and yet not have to talk?
Well, exactly. And you see, when I work with anybody, as I was speaking earlier, the mimicry, the identification with my sitter that is instinctive and a very necessary part of my working technique, I was identifying with Chris even after 33 years. And I was with him more intensely than I could be doing anything else. And so it began to seem like dying was something that we were doing together. I was with him. I was looking into his eyes and feeling him as well as looking at him. And that was so important to me. There was no other way I could have been so intimate with him. And that was wonderful for me. I think it was hard work for him. And he was often in discomfort and moaning.
Hard work for him in the sense that you wanted him to stay still and oppose so that you could draw him?
Well, he got into situations where, of course, he couldn't be still. And then he would go in and out of consciousness. But always I was there. I was there in a way that was much more intense than if I just stood by the bed looking at him. I was copying him. So I was with him the whole time.
In some of the sketches that you did of him when he was dying, he looks like he's in pain. And I was wondering if you let him...
He was.
Yeah, I was wondering if you let him see those drawings or if you wanted to protect him from looking at how pained he appeared to be. I mean, obviously he knew he was in pain, but sometimes it's not helpful to see how you look when you feel that way.
Well, you see, it's my habit to ask my sitters to sign and date my pictures of them because I feel the way I work is a perfect collaboration. And the better my sitter is, the stiller, the more concentrated my sitter, the better the work I do is likely to turn out. And when I began to concentrate only on Chris those last 6 months, he signed and dated the pictures I did for the first 3 or 4 months, and then he got beyond it. He couldn't sign and date anymore. So one day, he was in bed, and I'd done 6 or 7 pictures, and they were all black acrylic, and the paint was still wet. So I'd spread some of the pictures on the bed and some of them on the floor, and I was used by that time to his not being able to sign and date the pictures, so I hadn't even suggested it. And in fact, as I was picking up the pictures, being sure that they were dry, holding them up to the light, I thought he was asleep. And when I got the pictures together and was on my way out of the bedroom with them under my arm, he said to me from his bed, "I like the ones of him dying." And that absolutely threw me. I thought, my goodness, he's with me still. He's still urging me on, praising me for drawings of him dying. Now, I don't know, I've never heard of anybody else capable of that kind of consideration in the state that he was in.
After he died, you spent the rest of the day painting pictures of his corpse.
Yes, indeed.
Why did you want to
He'd once described my attitude to drawing and painting people, saying the people always had to be live sitters and that he wouldn't be the least bit interested in drawing a corpse. Well, he was absolutely right, with one exception. I would draw him in any state. And indeed, he died on a Saturday morning around 11, and I wasn't sure I could bring myself to do it, but I did start drawing him around 1 o'clock. And I worked all through the afternoon and early evening, and I'd done 11 drawings, and I was about to do a 12th when his doctor arrived at 8 o'clock that night. And I was relieved when she arrived, because already his corpse seemed to have so little to do with Chris. It had changed so completely that I was relieved not to have to do that 12th drawing. And also, I didn't want his doctor to think I scrambled to put the drawings away so she wouldn't see. Otherwise, I thought she'd think it was so ghoulish of me.
Had the body started to turn, and did the doctor think it was strange that...
It had just stopped being Chris, in spite of his characteristic, undeniable eyebrows, his nose, and his eyes were still open. But those eyes that had always flashed such energy, such sparkle, were just glassy, dead, glazed eyes.
Marriage wasn't close to being legal for gay people when you and Christopher Isherwood were a couple. But if, correct me if I'm wrong here, I think this is when he was sick, he adopted you so that you could make medical and legal decisions on his behalf, because that was your only way of having some kind of legal relationship that would be recognized for things like medical decisions. How strange was that, that he had to, like, adopt you in order for you to have a legal family connection to you?
Well, even though I was determined to keep him home when he got sick, there was a chance that he would have to go into hospital for some reason or other, and we were both worried that I wouldn't be given access. That was the only reason we adopted each other.
Did it work? You know, was it recognized in the way that you wanted it to be? Did it accomplish what you needed it to accomplish?
Well, it didn't really come into it. He did have to spend a few days in hospital during those last 6 months, and I just had a cot put in the room, and I slept beside his bed. But it didn't really enter into it. I never got anyone saying, you can't go into his room. But I know Chris would have cheered when gays were given the right to marry. We would both consider that a huge triumph, but it wouldn't have changed our attitude. We both of us agreed early on that any kind of legalization of our relationship was just not necessary for either of us.
I was reading an article from 1997 in the Harvard Gay and Lesbian Review. And in that 1997 article about you, it described you as having a partner who was 26 years younger than you, an age difference that was similar to the difference between you and Christopher Isherwood. And you were quoted as saying, "I couldn't find anybody to replace Chris, so I thought I'd try and find somebody who could play my role, so now I'm playing Chris." Are you still in that relationship?
No. It lasted for 10 years, and many of those 10 years were blissful years for me. And the young man moved into the house more than a year and a half after Chris died. You see, I'd learned so much with Chris. I was just longing to share it with somebody else. And yes, he was 26 years younger than I. And so I got this extraordinary experience of playing Chris's role with a much younger man. And it was so illuminating of all of my years with Chris. And I was so often saying to myself, when my young friend and I, he's asked me not to name him, that's why I'm being coy about his name, but when he and I would have quarrels or disagreements, or when we'd come together blissfully, I was always addressing Chris in my mind, saying, "Oh, that's what that situation was about. That's how you were feeling. Now I understand." And that was just, I believe it's called epiphany. Well, if that's what it's called, epiphany is great.
Are you in a relationship now?
I'm, for the first time in my life, having a very satisfactory relationship with somebody my own age. We were born the same year, 1934, and he's actually 3 months my junior. And he was somebody that I met on one of my trips to New York more than 40 years ago. And, of course, I was always frank with the people I had sex with in those years. And how could I not be? Because Chris was well known, and I, as his friend, I couldn't not be frank. So when the job that I was doing in New York was over, I came back to California, and I never saw this friend again until about 3.5, 4 years ago. I had a show at the Huntington, and he went to see it and wrote me a letter telling me how much he'd enjoyed it. So I wrote him back and said, why don't you come and sit for me again? I'd done drawings of him more than 40 years before, both portraits and nudes, and he did come to sit for me. And he rung the buzzer up at the gate, and I went out the house, and down the stairs came this man of my own age. Now, that was quite a surprise. And then I thought, well, what do you suppose he's seeing? He's seeing a man of his age, too. It was a charming reunion, and we did several sittings together, and now we spend a lot of time together and very much enjoy each other's company. So that's a pretty good development from my point of view.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
That was Don Bacardi. The story of his relationship with Christopher Isherwood is the subject of the new documentary, Chris and Don. The writer Thomas Dish shot and killed himself Friday after a series of devastating events, including a fire in his apartment, a flood in his home, and the death of his longtime partner. He also faced chronic health problems. Thomas Dish wrote science fiction for adults and children, as well as poetry and critical essays. In his New York Times obituary, he was described as writing dark themes, disturbing plots, and corrosive social commentary that made him a leader of what was called the new wave of science fiction. Dish was best known for his children's book, The Brave Little Toaster. The heroes were five loyal, dependable, small appliances. I spoke with him in 1988, after the publication of his sequel, The Brave Little Toaster Goes to Mars. In this story, Earth is threatened by an invasion of angry appliances who were exiled to Mars, victims of planned obsolescence. The brave little toaster and his friends journey into outer space to stop the invasion. Dish was surprised when I asked him why he gave his appliances personalities.
I think everybody, especially towards their toaster, regards them as personal. I mean, electricity... Is like blood. It's a living fluid, and it's hard not to think of appliances as having independent existences because they do things. They make noises. Radios talk to us. Toasters are kind to us. They reflect our faces. Sit down in the morning if you live by yourself, and the first positive relationship of your day is going to be with your toaster.
When my appliances have personalities, the personality is usually rebellious. When I think of my appliances as having personalities, it's always because they're out sick or they're rebelling against me. I went through a period where the TV was broken, the toaster oven was broken, my cassette deck was broken. And there was something wrong with my car.
The reason this may be happening to you is because you don't pay attention to them when they're serving you without complaint. And, you know, if you dealt with a person that way, no wonder they'd start breaking down, getting sick. You know, it's psychosomatic.
I'm interested in why you started writing children's books.
Well, the first one was The Brave Little Toaster, and it was written as a children's book. I wrote it just because I thought it was a beautiful idea. And I've written a few things in that vein since, some story poems. I've had stories that I wrote as science fiction stories and fantasies that were adapted for children's TV programs. There's a certain vein, false innocence is not the right word, because that suggests that it's false, and it isn't. It's quite sincere. The point is that there's a certain attitude that's that makes a story a children's story. And it's basically the Brave Little Toaster's attitude that everything is basically nice in the world, and that you only have to smile and other people will get along with you. And
now that attitude is more or less precisely the opposite attitude that you've taken in most of your science fiction books.
Well, then it's the opposite attitude to most adult literature. I mean, life is more complicated than that, but I think that it's a reasonable attitude to inculcate in children. I mean, a large part of the world will work on that assumption just fine. But it's probably not suitable for, you know, for long stretches of being a serious grown-up, right? If you look at the day's newspapers and try to think of how many of the problems there could be solved by that attitude, probably not many, huh?
You know, in 1970, you suggested that science fiction was a branch of children's literature. And I want to know what you meant by that.
A large part of science fiction, that's still true. The Star Wars and Star Trek series, their popularity has been with children and young teenagers. And, of course, the Brave Little Toaster story itself, insofar as it became easily and quickly the most popular thing I'd ever done, sort of bears out what I said, because I wrote it as a children's book, but when it first appeared as a science fiction story, it was very, very well received among people who might have had more difficulty with what you could say my serious science fiction. There's a saying in the field that the golden age of science fiction is 12. Right. That's the age you start reading it. Mm-hmm. No matter what year that was, that is your golden age of science fiction, because you can only enjoy your first kiss once, right?
Do you feel that inhibits you as a writer, that somehow you want to be addressing adults, but you suspect you're addressing 12-year-olds?
Well, it hasn't been a problem for me, because when I want to address adults, I do. There has been, as a result, pretty much of my generation of SF writers, starting in the middle 60s, Ursula Le Guin, Norman Spinrad, me, Sam Delaney, a lot of us decided that we would write science fiction for grown-ups, and we did. And now there is it's no longer a controversial undertaking. Of course, the problem that made it controversial is that an awful lot of the adult readers of science fiction then and now, of the simpler-minded sort of science fiction, didn't like to have it pointed out that their reading tastes weren't entirely adult. And so we got called names. I think the one that I always got was nihilist. And so I've spent the 20 years subsequent to that insisting that I'm not a nihilist. You know, no, I'm not.
Well, on the other hand, you have said that science fiction is a virtual treasury of ways of standing conventional wisdom on its head. Does that idea appeal to you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's why, even though it's been awkward sometimes to be labeled as a science fiction writer, because most people do associate it with the simple-minded Flash Gordon sort of thing, I continue to want to write it, because you can just do things with science fiction, especially satire, that you can't do anywhere else. You can't write 1984, for instance, and set it in the present. The special effects, the special intellectual effects that can be created in science fiction don't exist in realistic fiction. And so if that's what you want to do, there's no other way.
Thomas Dish recorded in 1988. He took his life Friday. He was 68. Ever since Mystery first aired on PBS, Americans have had a long fondness for British television shows about crime. One of the most popular British series is Rebus, based on the novels by the Scottish writer Ian Rankin about an Edinburgh detective inspector. Acorn Media has just brought out a new 4-disc set of Rebus stories, which originally aired in the U.S. on BBC America. Our critic at large, John Power, says the show has a distinctive allure.
Back in the mid-90s, I was going to Edinburgh for work. So I asked a well-traveled friend if he could recommend any good guidebooks. Guidebooks, he said. If you want to know about Edinburgh, read Ian Rankin. I did, and he was right. Rankin's novels do for Edinburgh what Raymond Chandler once did for L.A. They open up the city and give it an identity in the popular imagination. These days, Rankin is the United Kingdom's best-selling crime writer, the godfather of so-called tartan noir. And his hero, the flawed but dogged detective Inspector John Rebus, has become an international literary brand. He's also the star of a hugely popular British TV series called Rebus. The last season is just out on DVD, the best 3 episodes adapted from Rankin's novels, and it doesn't take long to see that it's far richer and far more socially observant than American hits like CSI or Law and Order. Consider the episode titled The First Stone, which begins with the discovery of 2 nude corpses in a car on Lover's Lane. One victim's a married woman, the other a high-profile minister in the Church of Scotland. The case falls to Rebus, played by veteran Scottish actor Ken Stott, and his still-green sidekick Siobhan Clark, that's Claire Price. Their investigation soon gets them mixed up with scheming church bigwigs, a controversial radio talk show host, a retired cop who insists he's being poisoned, and of course, inevitably, more murder. Through it all, Rebus is, well, Rebus, as tactful as a grizzly bear who's caught scent of your picnic basket. Here, he and Siobhan talk to the murdered woman's husband, a motorbike-ready mechanic who swears he was nowhere near the scene of the crime.
So, the night she died, you had a fight, she drove off, you followed again.
I told you, we had a fight, she walked out, I had a bit of a drink, I never saw her again.
The thing is, night of the murder, we've got CCTV coverage. And there was a bike just like that, right behind Iris's car. Now, we're having it enhanced, and I'm willing to bet it was you.
It wasn't me. Lost the keys. I haven't been on it in ages.
Come on, Tommy. You lost it. You couldn't bear the idea of them both together. You lost it. Tell me the truth. Let's finish it.
All right. I follow them. But I never touched them. I swear to God.
Right now, I think that's the last person you should be swearing to. Get your coat.
Although Rebus's personal life isn't developed as impressively on TV as it is in the novels, the episodes don't build as in, say, The Wire. The show does boast a terrific performance by Stott, a canny, rumpled crowd pleaser who has a spud of a nose and smokes his cigarette like a man on life support. Sly enough to find the charm in what's often merely exasperating, Stott captures the riddle that is Rebus, a born maverick whose obsessive impatience as a cop, he's forever defying his superiors, only accentuates his personal failings. He fouls up his love life, falls for women he shouldn't, and behaves selfishly toward Siobhan. He fuels such shortcomings with booze, self-pity, and gulps of single malt self-righteousness that would be unpalatable if he wasn't nearly always right. And then there's Edinburgh. Like nearly all hugely successful crime locales, be it Henning Mankell's Swedish Boondocks or Alexander McCall Smith's Botswana, the Rebus cycle is suffused with a mental atmosphere, a potently mythical sense of place. It's long been the power of mystery stories that they're so mobile. They feature detectives who explore the whole of society, from the corridors of power to the meanest of streets. Doing his job, Rebus shuttles between shishi art galleries and massage parlors offering more than massages. He deals with international tycoons and cops so crooked that they seem like refugees from a James Ellroy novel. Through his investigations, we come to see Edinburgh as a dank, tough, yet often breathtaking city. It's one caught between its resplendent past as the Athens of Britain and a modern metropolis plagued by crime, weaseling bureaucrats, and preening bigshots who still treat the city as a private fiefdom. It's a city of vast, enduring melancholy where people, rich and poor, are forever seeking some form of release. When somebody pours you a scotch in Rebus's world, it's never a wee dram. It's enough to stun a horse. In a way, we're drawn to mystery stories for much the same reason. Escape from daily reality, consolation for the fact that our lives don't work out as neatly as mysteries, and camaraderie with a hero who comes to feel like a reliable friend. In fact, one great secret of the modern crime novel is that much of the time, it's not ultimately about crime. It's about isolation, about loneliness, which is what makes John Rebus such a sympathetic figure. Brilliant at solving the most arcane of murders, he's baffled by something that sounds quite ordinary. How to stop feeling so terribly alone.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. He reviewed the latest set of Rebus mysteries on DVD.